A very interesting Rashi describing Reuven's attempts to rescue Yosef. Reuven is this almost tragic figure. His heart seems to be in the right place, but at least in this week's parsha, he comes up short. Vayishma Reuven, vayatzileo miadam, vayomer lo nakanu nefesh. Reuven intercedes, and all the expectations are that he's this hero that will prevent this dastardly crime. Vayomer elhem Reuven, al tishpichu dam, don't murder our brother. Hashlichu oto el habor hazeh, sheba midbar. V'yad al tishlichu bo, repeats himself twice, don't murder him and don't harm him in any way. Leman hatzilosam miadam, la'ashivo alaviv. At this point, the grammar changes abruptly. Leman hatzilosam miadam, la'ashivo alaviv, refers to Reuven in the third person. The first part of the pasuk was Reuven speaking to his brothers and the Torah recording that conversation. Vayomer alem Reuven, al tishbichu, don't spill his blood. Throw him into the boar. Don't hurt him. V'yad al tishlichu bo. And then the grammar, or the tense of the pasuk, shifts into an omniscient narrator describing Reuven, leman hatzilos al miyadam. Rashi, of course, senses the shift and comments. This happens several times in Tanakh. Leman hatzilos al ruach hakodesh mi'ita al Reuven. This is not Reuven speaking. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Ruach HaKodesh. The Ruach HaKodesh recording what Reuven's intentions were. And whenever the grammar shifts this way, let me just read the Rashi, Ruach HaKodesh Mi'idal Reuven Shalom Rezos El Lahatzel Oso Sheyavo Hu V'Yalenu Misham. Ruach HaKodesh is conveying Reuven's intentions. Reuven wanted to stall the process, rescue Yosef. Amar, he says, Ani ha-bechor, I'm the oldest. V'gadol shivakulan lo yitel ha-sirachon elabi. I'm the one that will take responsibility. I'm the one that's accountable. So Reuven's intentions were commendable. And the Torah highlights this by accentuating or emphasizing his intentions, the man hatzilosa. Whenever the grammar shifts this way, you have to ask yourself why there's such a sudden shift. Why all of a sudden does the Torah feel the need to intercede or interject with information that isn't being played out by the actual, as we would say, actors or participants? So, interestingly enough, in Vayeshev, this happens very often. On several occasions, this shift occurs. Just by way of one other example, when Yosef, two psukim before, when Yosef first comes, and the brothers are conspiring, L'chuvin argeva nashlicho b'yachad abaros, ve'amarnu chay arach alasu, let's thrust him into a boar, V'nir'eh ma yu chalomotav, and they were conspiring. So Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak, who says that this phrase, V'nir'eh ma yu chalomotav, let's see what will happen to his dreams. This was not a phrase which they actually said. V'nir'eh ma yu chalomotav. They didn't say what will happen to his dreams. This is instead Ruach HaKodesh, again the omniscient narrator of the Torah, actually rejecting this conspiracy. You think, so to speak, the Torah is telling the brothers that his dreams will be squashed or his dreams will be crushed. If anything, your conspiracy will advance, will accelerate the fruition of his dreams. And indeed, the sale of Yosef ultimately jumpstarts or kickstarts the fulfillment of his dreams. So interestingly enough, Vayeshev has several occasions in which the Torah interjects with a idea or a truth which isn't articulated by the people involved, but provided by the Torah, or as Rashi says, Lashon HaKodesh. It's so relevant to Parshas Vayeshev because Vayeshev has two narratives. There's the actual events that unfold, but then there's also, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's manipulation or engineering of these events. So events which seem to be tragic, or which seem to be, in some way, traumatic for personalities, become redemptive and triumphant. No, nothing more than the sale of Yosef, which seems to be a tragedy, ends up a triumph in Yosef's life and for the entire people, the entire clan. Yehuda's presumed wealth and stature ultimately thrusts him into a very humiliating and mortifying position. So there's a clear interplay between human beings who take certain efforts and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we would say, Kol Hashgacha, or divine providence, which re-engineers their actions into a larger divine plan. So this communication or dialogue between the actual people and the Ribbono Shel Olam is an important dialogue because it reminds us of Hashgacha Pratis, sometimes in ways that are hard for human beings to detect, especially when they're in the heat of the moment. But there is a particular importance to what Rashi is saying regarding Reuven. The Torah is informing us of Reuven's intention. Reuven didn't announce his intention. He just said, don't throw him into the pit and don't hurt him. He couldn't and didn't say in order to save him. Now, part of why he couldn't and didn't say in order to save him is because he may have been afraid of his brothers. The more murderous and aggressive brothers may have been angered by his attempts. So he was very vague and very ambiguous in his suggestion. But part of it was also internally. As I mentioned earlier, Reuven is one of these tragic figures whose, you would say, heart is in the right place, but he's unable to generate the conviction and the decisiveness to intervene in swift and convincing fashion. So the pasuk, after Reuven attempts to save him, quickly switches to the actual sale, and then a little bit later, several pasukim later, Vayashav Reuven al Habar, Vayashav el Achav, Reuven returns. Where was he? So Chazal have different opinions as to where he was, but clearly he paused or hesitated, he flinched. Geographically, or according to some positions, psychologically, he withdrew from the process. And then when he returned to finish this rescue, it was, as we would say, too little, too late. And that's part of the reason that Reuven abdicates the Bechor. It's not just about the right ideas and the right intentions, but about the execution, as we would say. And this grammatic shift highlights both Reuven's sincerity and his well intentions, or his good intentions, but also the inability to actually assert and execute those intentions. So he's not even able to assert the intention to save Yosef. The Torah has to supplement it and provide the information that's missing from Reuven's erstwhile bold announcement. So here the grammar and the style very much reflect the substance and the content. This whole ambiguity in Reuven's heart is conveyed by his inability to announce his intention to rescue his brother. The Torah has to provide it, Laman Hatziloso, Ruach HaKodesh Mevaser. That's one very interesting Rashi. Another interesting Rashi is about the brothers themselves. I'm actually going backwards. For Lo Yichlu Dabar L'Shalom, the brothers hated Yosef, and they couldn't even speak to him kindly or nicely. It's in Pasuk Dalet. Vayishnu Osav V'Lo Yichlu Dabar L'Shalom. So this Rashi sounds like it's a little bit of a Hasidic Rashi. The Hasidim were known. I talked about this in an earlier shiur this week about the role of the tzaddik and why Yosef was an incomplete tzaddik because he chastised and rebuked rather than defending. So the role of the modern tzaddik is to always find, always highlight positive traits in people, redeeming traits in people. So this Rashi plays that role. This pasuk is very much an indicting pasuk of the brothers. They hated him. They couldn't speak to him with harmony, couldn't speak to him peacefully. Rashi says, Mitoch genusam lemedim shvacham. Amidst this whole critique of the pasuk, there certainly is a redeeming quality. What is the shvach shelo dibru achas bepeh, v'achas belev? That despite, or even though they disliked him, and they despised and contempted Yosef, they weren't manipulative. They didn't speak to him one way, in a way that was kind and favorable and endearing, while harboring deep-seated resentments. Whatever they felt, they spoke. As we would say, they were frank, they were candid, they were transparent. They spoke the truth, rather than sanitizing the truth or wrapping the truth in sugar-coated doublespeak, as we would say. So this is an interesting value, and it's a value that has to be metered, as all values, very carefully. As I currently record the shiur, I'm thinking about the American elections, the run-up to the 2016 elections. And one of the outsiders who's gaining popularity is Donald Trump. And one of his appeals is he says the truth as is. He doesn't hold any punches. He speaks the unadorned, honest truth about race relations, about the United States, military power, whatever. Very often in a sanitized society in which pictures are photoshopped, statements are carefully metered and cropped, which things are prepackaged, people have an uncontrollable appetite for unadorned truth. And this candidate is in part exploiting that appetite. He has the courage to say that which others will never let themselves say. It happens in every field. I'm in education. I've seen rabbis who are very popular simply because they say brazen things and because they assert ideas that capture people's imagination because they don't undergo any cosmetic adaptation. On the other hand, we live in a world which requires diplomacy and tact and understanding and possessing emotional intelligence and understanding the context and saying things that are sensitive to other human beings, saying things that are broad enough to embrace different opinions and different ideas. So in general, that value between the unadorned truth and processed ideas that are contextualized is an important balance, in particular in interactions with other human beings. When it comes to the halacha of lotisna asachicha bilvavecha, of how we deal with those who we hate, we're hating other people, so there happens to be a very interesting machlokas. The Rambam claims that the only isser is if you actually, as Rashi suggests, if you hate someone, but you conceal that hatred and speak as a friend, and speak out of presumed friendship and solidarity. That duplicity, that manipulation, is what's prohibited through lotisna. In theory, if a person dislikes another Jew and tells him frontally or doesn't in any way hide his dislike, he hasn't violated lotisna. The Lashon HaPasuk, lotisna asachicha bilvavecha, suggests it's only the concealed, engineered, fake, and inauthentic presentation. Other Rishonim differ with the Rambam. So in general, it's important in our communication in general to balance between, on the one hand, non-manipulative speech, on the other hand, tactful and sensitive speech, as we would call it tact and emotional intelligence, and in particular with people who we may like more or less, to be able to thread that line and not be inauthentic, on the other hand, not be hurtful or hateful in our speech. One final Rashi, I know it's a little bit late, but one final Rashi, right after the sale of Yosef has concluded, the story of Yehuda is introduced, and Yehuda, as we know, loses two children, ultimately becomes involved in a very, as we would say, a very seedy relationship with his daughter-in-law, which bears two future Jewish leaders, Jewish dynasty, Peretz and Zerach. But the original story is introduced by a very interesting preface. Vayered Yehuda me'esachav. So the Torah describes Yehuda descending. The descent is geographical. He moves to the south. He visits a town called Adullam, and he interacts with a man named Chira. But Rashi suggests, and the pasuk itself connotes that it wasn't just a geographical descent, but it was a personal descent. Yehuda felt the need to walk away from his brothers. One can imagine that he was filled with shame and embarrassment and mortification that he had led them astray, witnessing the suffering of Yaakov. What's interesting is that Rashi highlights it wasn't just Yehuda who took that step, but the brothers themselves made that decision. Lama nismecha parsha zu lekan? Rashi continues, lelameit shehoridu echav migdulaso. He had been appointed some degree, some sort of leader. It's not clear that it happens before the sale of Yosef, but certainly at the sale, he stepped forward and assumed leadership by directing the sale. At this point, the brothers were so displeased with the outcome that they replaced him, and they as we would say, they fired Yehuda, or they supplanted him. Kisharo b'tzaras aviyim. When they saw Yaakov suffering, Amru ata amarta l'machro, you told us, you instructed us to sell Yosef, ilo amarta l'shiva hoyu neshamim l'cha. We would have listened. Now, there's certainly some degree of projection. It's always easier to blame the leader. We don't sense any resilience or any resistance on the part of the brothers. But what's interesting is that this leadership, which led to such suffering and to such hatred, and to such tension and dissonance, can't survive. There's too much guilt, there's too much shame. Very often people band together, create organizations to accomplish great things. Sometimes politics stands in the way. But in an ideal situation, when an organization of people leads and yields high-minded ideas, you're proud to be affiliated, and that pride creates both deeper organizational bonds, commitment to whatever project you're involved in, and hopefully belief and pride in the person leading you because you realize there are larger goals that excite you, that inspire you, make you proud to affiliate with that organization. This was an organization of brothers, a collection of brothers who affiliated, and they committed a terrible crime. And they're embarrassed. And part of our way to deal and cope with embarrassment is to flee, is to try to ignore it as best we can. That's a natural response. Some of it is contrition. Some of it is improvement and penitence, but part of it is denial or cordoning it off. And because of that, their bonds to the structure they created in the hierarchy, atop which Reuven is the leader, are very weak. They'd rather not engage in reinforcing that organization. Therefore, that organization or that hierarchy crumbles on its own. So whether they officially removed Yosef from his position or just fizzled, but when Chazal say, Kol machlokas she'i l'shem shemayim sofa l'skayim, kol machlokas she'ein l'shem shemayim ein sofa l'skayim, whenever people engage jointly in an agenda or a project which ultimately provides guilt and shame, that's an organization that's less likely to draw interest and reinforcement. And that's why Yehuda's leadership is very short-lived, at least at this stage. In future parashiyos, we'll see that Yehuda makes a comeback. So the three Rashis we spoke about were, number one, Reuven's equivocating nature, the fact that his intentions to rescue Yosef are provided or supplied not by his own voice, but by the omniscient narrator of Ruach HaKodesh. Number two, the brothers despised Yosef, but at least weren't duplicious in hiding their resentment. And finally, Yehuda is removed from power because this alliance had caused such grief and ultimately such guilt and mortification. Shabbat Shalom.